The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
From West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on GBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. I'll be taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 10th day of September. Our engineer, Brian Graves, right across the way as usual. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the former offensive lineman, Super Bowl champion, and now Hall of Fame nominee for another time, Jerry Kramer. And in the second half, we'll speak to the last 30-game winner in Major League Baseball. Hopefully, Denny McClain will join us. If not, we have the spaceman, Bill Lee, waiting in the wings to fill that slot. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest, 11-year National Football League career with the Green Bay Packers, an integral part of the famous Packers sweep, that signature play that they used so effectively back then, a 5-time All-Pro, 2-time Super Bowl champ, 5-time NFL champion, and 3-time Pro Bowl selection. He's the nominee for the Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2018. I'd like to welcome tonight Jerry Kramer. Jerry, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. Great to be with you.
Great to have you with us once again. You were on a few years ago. I'm sure you don't remember, but we look forward to another visit with you tonight. Now, you were born in Montana. You moved from Utah to Idaho. Back in high school and college, Jerry, who did you root for? Who were some of your favorite players that might have influenced you a little bit?
Well, my number one guy was King at the University of Washington.
Okay.
Running back. It was a wonderful running back. He was kind of my hero, but Hugh McElhaney was his real name, but everybody called him the King.
Okay.
Was a Los Angeles Ram fan. My high school yearbook quoted me as saying I wanted to play for the Los Angeles Rams as a profession when I grew up. So I didn't get to play with the Rams, but I had a wonderful run with Green Bay.
You certainly did. No regrets there, I'm sure. Now, the 1958 NFL draft, you were taken 39th, and what a draft that was for the Packers, because they also got a guy from LSU by the name of Jim Taylor at number 15, and then at number 36, an Illinois linebacker by the name of Ray Nitschke.
Yeah, it was one of the top drafts. They also got a linebacker named Dan Curry, who was an All-American and probably had more stats than any of the folks drafted. And he was a wonderful ball player and tore his knee up early and had to leave the game.
Shame. Now, in 59, the Packers also make another change by bringing in the offensive coach of the New York Giants, a fellow by the name of Vince Lombardi. Now, he had some influence on your career, Jerry.
Yes, he did. It was a kind of an odd situation, Bill. You know, the rumor was that Curly Lambeau was wanting to come back to Green Bay. Mm-hmm. And everybody was pretty excited about that. Curly had quite a bit of success and championships and whatnot. And then they hired a coach from Brooklyn who had never coached as a head coach other than at high school. And so they wondered what in the world was going on.
Yeah.
And we wondered what in the world was going on. And after a couple, 3 practices, we knew what was going on. This is a whole new deal, a whole new game, a whole different look at football. This was professional football. We were playing kind of semi-amateur football the year before when we went 1-10-1 and had the worst record in the history of the franchise. So Mr. Lombardi was quite an experience.
Came in, and like you say, Jerry, boy, did things change. Jerry Kramer with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, the Pack won 5 NFL titles and the first 2 Super Bowls. People may not know about that. You were also a place kicker, Jerry, which is a unique situation, and you had some success there as very well.
Yeah, I kicked in college, and when I first started playing, Bill, there were only 36 players. So you didn't have quite, you know, 2 squads, and so somebody had to learn to play both ways. And if you could play both ways, like maybe offensive guard, defensive tackle, or offensive guard, linebacker, or guard, kicker, then you were a little more valuable, and you were more likely to keep your job. And at that time, although we didn't make a fraction of the money these gentlemen are making today, we wanted to keep our job, so I was a kicker, and I kicked in Green Bay. I actually scored 177 points, I believe it was, over when Horning was busted up or suspended or had some other problems. But I didn't, you know, I didn't regard myself as a kicker. I was a guard,
right?
And I was pressed into duty every once in a while.
Now, yeah, there was a specific game that I'm recalling, Jerry. It was the game at Yankee Stadium against the Giants. The Packers took that game 16-7. You kicked 3 field goals that day and an extra point. Do you remember that day?
Well, I remember very well. I remember walking into Yankee Stadium. It was awesome. I was just overwhelmed. I had listened to boxing matches from Yankee Stadium and World Series games, and I lived way back in the hills in Idaho, and Yankee Stadium was a faraway golden castle on a, on a big hill, and it was impossible for mortals like me to ever get to Yankee Stadium.
Right.
So when we walked in the place, we look out in the center field, and there's Ruth and DiMaggio and Gehrig and Mick and, you know, the statues out there and the ghosts around the stadium were tremendous. And Coach Lombardi says, "Jerry, take the guys out and walk them around a little bit. Settle them down." I said, "Who's going to settle me down?"
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I got out there and I was going to kick the first field goal. And I made the mistake of looking across the line of scrimmage, and I saw Huff and Mojuleski and Cat Cabbage and Lynch and the whole wonderful New York Giant defense, and my little heart went titty-pat, and my stomach flip-flopped, and my legs started shaking a little bit. And I said, "Just keep your head down and follow through. Be fundamental." So I kicked the ball, and I followed through very well. And when I looked up, the ball had actually gone through the goalpost, but it was outside the goalpost when I looked up. And I looked at the official, and he had his arms in the air, signaling good. And I go, "What's he doing? What is going on?" And Bart says, "Shut up and get off the field." And I said, okay. So that was my first field goal.
Outstanding, yeah. Now, you had the unfortunate situation, Jerry, to have a lot of injuries during your career. 22 surgeries in 11 seasons. Now, that included a colostomy. What happened there?
Well, it was a kind of a freak accident.
Yeah.
When I was about 16 years old, I was living on the edge of the country, and we had a cow and a calf and a big garden, 6 kids. And I was chasing a calf to try to get it back in a pen. I wanted to go swimming down the beach, and my father was a fairly strict gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew if he came home and that calf was out, my backside would then get tanned pretty good. So I'm trying to catch it by the tail, and it steps on a 1x6, kind of steps in the center of it and splinters it into a sharp, spear-shaped end and the other flat side. Well, of course, the flat side stays against the ground, and the spear-shaped end comes up and hits me just above the leg and the groin. That was within a half inch of coming out my back.
Wow.
So It took me into Spokane and had an operation. They went in the front and they went down to the point of, they went to the back. There was a sliver about 7.5 inches long, about as big around as my thumb, and it was lodged in the muscle along the spine. So they went in there and pulled that sliver out, but they didn't look to see between the point of entry and that middle part of my stomach. So 11 years later, I developed a tumor on my liver about the size of a grapefruit, and I'm 64. I missed all but a couple games that year, and so they operate on me, and then they find I have a puncture in my intestine.
Oh, man.
So they send me to Mayo, and Mayo operates on me and resects the intestine, and the operation didn't hold. The stitching burst, filled the abdominal cavity with stool, and so now I have a colostomy put in, and I'm a pretty sick puppy at this time.
Sure.
I finally go home. I'm 189 pounds.
Oof.
I arrive in Green Bay just as somebody else had passed away, and there was a big rumor that I had died.
Oh.
And so we end up having a wake. We had about 25 ball players in town, and they brought a keg of beer and a headstone and some flowers, and we had my wake over at the house.
Can't beat
so
that.
I enjoyed it. It was a wonderful
way. Yeah. Outstanding. Now, Jerry, in 1967, I believe it is, you collaborated with the great Dick Schaap on the classic book Instant Replay, which, if folks don't know, was a diary of the season, really chronicling the life of Jerry Kramer, a professional football offensive lineman. Now, give us a little insight into how that book came about and how you worked with Dick Schaap to bring it to fruition.
Well, Dick and I were casually acquainted, and he called me and he said, Jerry, I've been talking to a publisher in New York, and we'd like to do a book, and we'd like you to do a book with us.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what do you mean, do a book? He said, write a book. Dick, what the hell I know about writing a book? I don't know how to write a book. I can read. I can write. I'm generally pretty coherent, but I haven't this clue about doing a book. He said, well, you know, we'll get a tape recorder, and you'll record your impressions, your daily events, and your happenings on the field, and your teammates, and anything that might be interesting, and send it to me, and I'll work it into a chapter, and we'll make a book. I said, who gets final say? He said, you do.
Okay.
I said, let's talk.
Yeah.
So I came to New York, and we had a chat with the publisher, and the publisher said, you know, traditionally, sports books don't sell. So if we sell 7,500 to 10,000 books, we'll do well. That'll be good. So we sold 440,000 books. We were on the bestseller list for 44 weeks, number two for 16 weeks, and number one for 4 weeks. And Dick was a very bright, very intelligent, gifted human being and a beautiful person. He's one of my all-time great pals. And I trusted him with everything I could think of. And I would say something kind of off left field. Dick, would this be interesting? Let's say that for another book. Let's not go there right now. Let's not do this. But that part you talked about last week about being up on the mountains on the spring where the water is crystal clear and jumping out of a rock, and that's good stuff. That's good. He said, I can imagine you on the football field and thinking about those mountain springs. So we worked awfully close together. Dick, there would be a letter to an editor or a letter to a publication of some kind, and Dick would mock up a letter and send it to me, and the first time I changed 6, 7, 8, 10 things. You know, no, I didn't want to say that. No, that's not the way I would say it. And the second time I changed 3 or 4 things. And the third time I didn't have to change anything. So he kind of got inside my head, and he kind of thought like I thought, or he knew how I thought. And we just had a wonderful relationship and a great trust and a great friendship. In fact, Jeremy Schaap is my godson, and was named after me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what a wonderful...
It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
The whole thing, we did a lot of interviews. You know, we didn't have the internet, so we traveled for about 6 months doing shows, you know, like early morning livestock shows, the late night Detroit, and everything in between. But it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, and folks should try to get a hold of a copy of Instant Replay, really the forerunner, really the one of the first great diary sports books. People should definitely look for a copy of that out in Barnes & Noble or on Amazon. Very well worth the read. Now, you also worked, Jerry, as a color commentator on CBS. How did you enjoy that?
You know, I enjoyed it a lot. I loved the game, and I felt like I understood the game fairly well after 11 years. And I was offered the 6 o'clock, 11 o'clock news in New York. Rue Narlich was running ABC Radio at that time, and Howard Cosell was a good friend. So I came in and did a little test with Howard and was offered the job. And I went back home. I said, I don't know. You know, I've got 3 children. And we live in Idaho, and I live 35 miles outside of town in Idaho. And I just don't think it would be a good idea for me to try to bring my children to New York. And, of course, I didn't know about the surrounding countryside or other areas that we might live. I just saw New York City and thought, boy, these potatoes will be fried potatoes in no time at all. And it would just really be a good, bad idea to take those children to New York City. So I decided I couldn't do the job, couldn't take the job, and I've always wondered about that crossing the roads there and what might have happened if, but I think I made the right decision for me and the family.
Now, you also had an idea for a book called Distant Replay, Jerry. How did that come about? Talk to us a little bit about that. Of course, it was a chronicle of the great Packer teams following a reunion. I believe it was in 1984.
Well, we had such a powerful coach, and he had such an incredible set of principles and beliefs, and they were things like commitment, consistency, discipline, perseverance, pride, character, belief in your game and your team, tenacity. And he talked to us and lectured us on those qualities. And they're the kind of qualities that I think are virtually impossible to be without in virtually any endeavor. No matter what you try to do, you've got to have commitment. You've got to have discipline. You've got to have these qualities. And so I thought all of our guys had learned from the master what life was all about, and we were willing to pay the price, we were willing to sacrifice, we were willing to do what we had to do to win. And so I thought it would be interesting to see, like, this was like 17, 18 years after we had left the field, I thought it would be interesting to see what kind of an impact coaches' teachings and coaches' philosophy had on the guys. And it was a fascinating journey, Horning and Taylor and Fuzz and all the guys were interesting and were doing very well, and all of them were successful to a certain degree, some more than others. But those qualities and the coach's principles made life a little easier and made achievement a little easier. So it was a fun book to do. I traveled all over the country and went to their hometown, went fishing with them, went to the post office with them, played golf with them, did whatever was necessary to get a story, and I enjoyed that book a lot. They make a great pair, Instant Replay and Distant Replay, because there's about 20 years in between, and a lot of guys had a lot of different thoughts about this, that, and the other, so it might be a nice read to get both books.
I'm sure it would be, and I recommend that to people and encourage them to look for both of those books, Instant Replay and Distant Replay by Jerry Kramer. Let's talk a little bit about the great teammates that you played with, Jerry. First of all, let's look at the quarterback, Bart Starr, a guy that you were in front of most of the time.
Bart was a very bright human being, very thoughtful, very intelligent, quiet. And people often mistook the quiet for softness, or a lack of strength in his backbone, or a lack of physical character. He had all the character he needed. He was just quiet. we were playing the Chicago Bears in Chicago one time, and they've always had a great middle linebacker, Butkus, Singletary, right. Urlacher, Bill George. Haven't had a great quarterback for 100 years, but they've had a lot of great linebackers. And this day, Bart threw a long pass down the sidelines, and my defensive tackle stopped and turned around and watched the ball. I'm watching the ball. Bart's watching the ball. Bill George isn't watching the ball. Bill's coming. He's got about a 5-yard run, and he hits Bart in the mouth with a forearm, knocks him back on his backside, and says, "That ought to take care of you, star, you putting the hit." And Bart says, "Bleep you, Bill George. We're coming after you." And I looked at Bart, and I went, "Wow, look at here."
Yeah.
And his bleeding, his lip was split up into his nose. And he was bleeding like a stream of blood just flowing down the front of his jersey. And I said, "Bart, you better get to the sideline and get sewed up. You're bleeding like a stuck hog." He says, "Shut up and get in the huddle." I said, "Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir." So Bart took us down the field about 7, 8, 9 plays. We scored, went to the sidelines. They laid him down on the bench and sewed him up. We were as gentle as these young boys are today. They didn't take us to the locker room. They just got to the nearest bench and sewed us up.
Yeah.
And Bart never missed a play. He went back in the game. He talked a little funny because his lip was sticking way out. But he didn't miss a play. And he took us down the field for another score. And at that time, Bart Starr became our leader and our number one guy in our organization, and everybody believed in him and threw in with him.
Great
story.
Now,
you take that with Horning and Taylor, two of the best running backs we've seen in a long, long time. You put Bob Skoronski and Forrest Gregg in the offensive line at tackle, Jim Ringo, Hall of Famer at center. Fuzzy and I were playing guard, and Max McGee was an offensive end, a wideout. Ron Kramer, 250-pound tight end, was an All-American basketball player, could high jump 6 foot, throw the shot put 60 foot, wonderful athlete. And so we had a wonderful bunch of talent, but we hadn't utilized the talent. We didn't have the fire. We didn't have the burn. We didn't have the drive, the need, the want, the hunger. Until Coach Lombardi came, and he put us into that mindset. He made us willing to sacrifice and to be committed and to be disciplined and to pay the price for everything. So that was a tremendous combination, and that's why we won 5 titles today, Bill.
Certainly was. Yeah, great description there, Jerry. Jerry Kramer, of course, our guest tonight on Sports Talk 1240. The Hall of Fame, Jerry. You've been nominated numerous times, never made it over the hump. This time in 2018, the Veterans Committee decides to place you up for nomination, and we're going to give it another try. Give us your feelings on that upcoming event.
Well, it's been quite an up and down period for me, being nominated, not getting in, being nominated, not getting in, being a finalist, not getting in. And so, you know, after a while, you get your lip out a little bit, and you get a little angry, and you get a little upset, and, well, you know what they can do with it. If they want me, they can come get me. I'm not even going to anything to do with the Hall of Fame. And then I start thinking about it one day. I'm out fishing with a couple of buds, and I'm having a slow day. But I think, you know, the game has been awfully good, Jerry. It's been just a wonderful ride for you. It's given you 100 presents, and it hasn't given you the one present that you really would love to have, the Hall of Fame, but it has given you 100 presents. So it would be kind of small or little of you to be angry because you got 100 presents and you didn't get 101. So I got a kind of an accommodation with myself. And I said, you know, that's right. That's silly to have all these wonderful things happen to you, the championships, the guys, the books, the many wonderful events in my life, and be angry because I didn't get one. That's kind of stupid. So I came to a conclusion that I was all right with that, that if it didn't happen, it didn't happen, that I loved the game and the Packer fans that supported me. unbelievably well, and they were just really a tremendous group of fans. So I was pretty comfortable with not being in the Hall of Fame. And when David Baker called me, I didn't know exactly what to think, whether this was a crank call or a prank or somebody was messing with me or what. But my little heart jumped up in my throat and helmet flipped a couple times, and I went, wow. Wow, this is really happening, and I got another shot. I got another opportunity. So it was a wonderful moment for me, and it was a wonderful thing to be a finalist for the NFL Hall of Fame. And if it happens, wonderful. If it doesn't happen, life has been wonderful, and it's been a wonderful ride. And Jerry Kramer is one very grateful human being.
Well, you really sorted that out with yourself wonderfully, Jerry. Myself, if that happened to me, guys like Joe Klecko, everybody has different ways of dealing with the disappointment of not being elected to the Hall. Football, baseball, all the same. But you certainly have fought the battle with yourself and come out as a victor in that, Jerry, and you're to be commended for that. I'd like to thank you, Jerry, for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you, and we look forward to seeing you in Canton in 2018.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you, Bill.
You take care. Have a good night, Jerry.
Thank you.
Jerry Bye. Kramer, folks. Next up, we will talk to the spaceman, Bill Lee. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the contact us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, welcome back, folks. Sports Talk 1240, Bill Donahue with you on this Sunday evening. Week one of the NFL, and of course the New York Jets killing us already. Went down to the Buffalo Bills today. Giants playing this evening. Hope they fare a little better, and we will watch the outcome of that ball game. Well, my next guest played for the Boston Red Sox and the Montreal Expos during his career. He was inducted into the Red Sox Hall of Fame as the team's record holder for most games pitched by a left-hander and the third highest win total by a Red Sox southpaw. I'd like to welcome into the show tonight the spaceman, Bill Lee. Bill, good evening.
Good evening out there. I'm on the West Coast, 97 degrees, not a breath of wind.
Whoa.
You know, but at least I'm going to have a lot of work this fall when I go down to play ball in Florida because I'll be rebuilding ballparks.
Yeah, I don't think they're faring too well down there, Bill. Our thoughts are with them, and it's going to be rough. But with people like you lending a hand, I'm sure they'll come out on top. Now, you were born in Burbank, California, Bill.
Yes, I was. Downtown, beautiful Burbank.
Beautiful downtown Burbank, as they used to say, sure. And then you were born into a family of semi-pro ball players. Your grandfather was an infielder for the Hollywood Stars, and was your aunt really named Annabelle Lee?
Yes, Annabelle was the greatest pitcher in L.A., and she signed with Wrigley, and she threw the first perfect game, the first no-hitter. She was traded a lot to build up other franchises, Fort Wayne Daisies, uh-huh. Grand Rapids Chicks, and the AAA, actually, back in the old days, was just as good as the major leagues. People didn't want to. You made more money playing out in Hollywood than you did going back, or about the same money as you played for the New York Giants. So,
wow.
Yeah, my grandfather played up until 1918, I believe.
Now, that I was just, when I came across the name, though, I said, how poetic that is of Annabelle Lee. What a great name.
Yeah, when she won the perfect game, they have a poem that they did to her in the same iambic pentameter as Edgar Allan Poe.
That's great.
Changed the lyrics, but the same pentameter.
Outstanding. Now, you went to USC, you majored in phys ed and geography, and you played for the great Ron Dado out there.
Yes, I did. Winningest coach, I think, won 7 national championships in a row. We won in 68, didn't win in 69, but then they rattled off, I think, 7 more with Freddie Lynn, Dave Kingman, and you know, all those great players of the early 70s.
Yeah, just a few. Some great guys coming out of USC. Now, you didn't really have a great fastball, Bill. You developed some off-speed pitches, including a variation of the famous Ephus pitch, which you called the Leafus pitch. Now, give us a little insight into that.
Well, I never named it. Other
oh,
people
okay.
name it. Yeah, I never,
all right.
I never bring up my name. You know, it's kind of like improper. I'm basically pretty easygoing. I threw just hard enough. Let's put it that way. I thought I had a really good fastball. What I did is I had command of it at the age of 9, and I was a 4-pitch pitcher coming out of Little League. I don't think I lost a game in Little League. I didn't play Pony League. Kind of rested. My arm kind of got sore at the longer distance. But then I went to high school, and I had a tremendous career until I tore up my knee my senior year. I was undrafted, threw 2 no-hitters in high school. But I could, you know, I always tell people, you know, I could never, I couldn't throw, but boy, I could pitch. And that's the attitude I've carried through my whole life. And boy, can I can still dot I's, you know, throw a double 20 on a dartboard anytime I need a case of beer. You know, that's
sure.
my life.
Now, the 1975 World Series, Bill, against the Cincinnati Reds, you pitched 2 games in that series. You lost both of them, but I don't think you did too badly.
I got 2 no decisions. I left with a 2-1 lead in the 9th in Game 1, which we should have won, and then there would have been a no Game 7. And I don't even think of Game 7 as a game because I wanted to win Game 2 so badly. But after the rain delay, the manager never had the foresight to bring in Roger Maret. If he brings in Roger Maret right at the beginning of the 9th inning, you know, he throws 9 fastballs, past 3 hitters, and we win the World Series on Fisk home run. And that's how I view it if I was managing that ball club.
Right, exactly. Bill Lee with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. 1978, let's talk about Don Zimmer a little bit. He was the skipper of the Red Sox. You seemed to clash with him a little bit. We had the Buffalo Heads. Now, I spoke to Bernie Carbo about that. Had Bernie on the show a while back, and we discussed the Buffalo Heads. Hall of Famer Fergie Jenkins was involved there. Give us a little spiel about the Buffalo Heads, Bill.
Well, we were formed. We kind of formed after we realized Zimmer was the master of the Peter Principle, rising to the level of your inability to manage. And he was a great coach, but a terrible manager. You can look at his record with San Diego, the Red Sox, everywhere he went. He was like Gene Mock, always reaching for the brass ring way too soon.
Right.
Didn't like pitchers. hated him because he had steel plates in his head. And if you read The Young Innocents out about the 60 Dodgers, you know, when Alston was manager and DeRocher always was looking to get his job, never did. And if you look at DeRocher in 62 playoffs against the Giants, when he moved the rookie second baseman away from second when Harvey Keene was playing, mm-hmm. you'll see that Don Zimmer made the same mistake in game seven, you know, when he moved Denny Doyle away from second base with bench hitting, and we don't turn the double play. I give up the home run to Perez. You know, Zimmer and DeRocher were very similar personalities from the same organization. The Young Innocents is one of the great books I've read on baseball this year anyway.
Okay, now, you also coined the great nickname the Gerbil.
Yeah, I named him that, and I got letters from a lot of people saying, Mr. Lee, I believe you meant a hamster, and I believe you should apologize to all the gerbils on the planet Earth. So that was a true story, yeah. And Zimmer, you know, I just basically, here's what I said. They said, what do you think about Billy Martin? I said, Billy Martin is a no-good dirty rat. I said, he let his daughter rot in a Peruvian jail for like 6 weeks, you know, without paying bail. Uh-huh. And the rats, you know, they eat their young when they're in a starvation situation. And I said, then they said, well, what's Don Zimmer? I said, oh, he's fat, got big puffy cheeks. You know, children love him. He's a gerbil. It was actually a compliment in relationship to my my vengeance against that reprobate from Oakland.
Exactly, yes, Mr. Martin. How did you feel about leaving Boston?
Didn't like it, cried, you know. Yeah. And then I went to Montreal and found out the bars stayed open till 6 in the morning. And, you know, I had a tremendous first season. I was 10-10 in 78 with the Red Sox. I was 10-10 at the All-Star break with a new manager, Dick Williams, who wanted me. He left me in the rotation. I won my last 6 games. I ended up 16-10. I beat Carlton out as left-hander of the year for National League.
Not
you know,
too
I loved it.
Yeah.
I didn't believe in free agency, even though I was player rep. I stayed in Montreal, took a giant cut in salary, and eventually got blackballed by John McHale and Fanning and those guys. And then Tom Haller and the Giants organization, he blackballed me, didn't let me try out for the Giants. And I was really throwing well after I came back after, you know, I think in 84, 85. And, you know, I ended up playing senior ball in Canada, where Reardon was, and a lot of guys that played in the major leagues, and had an ERA of 0.91 or something like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, I got in really good shape again, but I couldn't get a job. And I'm kind of like Kaepernick. Kaepernick's going through what I went through a long time ago. My sin was not the American flag. My sin was being a player's representative and creating the reserve clause in free agency.
Yeah. What you said about Boston was, who wants to be a team that'll go down in history alongside the 64 Phillies and the 67 Arabs? Right?
Yeah, I did say that, yeah. Yeah, I'm too quick for my own good, you know. I'm pretty sharp-witted, and I have more degrees than a thermometer, so I took economics. I didn't just take geography and physical education. Got a pretty good working knowledge of geology, too, and read a lot of John McPhee from, you know, Princeton. I'm basically a self-taught person mm-hmm. after college. I learned more after college than I sure did in college.
Bill Lee with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I always remember Tug McGraw when they asked him about artificial turf. Which did he prefer, artificial turf or grass? And he said, well, I never smoked artificial turf, so I can't really tell you that. Now, your views on mandatory drug testing, what did you have to say about that, Bill? You remember?
Yeah, when Bowie Kuhn fined me and everything, and then they interviewed me about mandatory drug testing, I said, you know, I tested them all. I don't think it should be mandatory.
Yeah.
So I just, I have a way of using Kurt Gödel's Epimedes' paradox in a lot of my statements. I beat Alan Dershowitz in a court of law with Johnny Cochran in the Pete Rose trial of the century on ESPN. Everybody can look that up, you know, and I beat Dershowitz in his own house.
Yeah.
You know, I win a lot of, I listen, I listen and I can turn, flip people around, change people. You know, I'm kind of like a conjurer or a midget clairvoyant wanted by the law.
Okay.
You know what that is?
No, go ahead.
It's a small medium at large.
Ah. Oh, that's a good one, Bill. Yeah, I'll have to write that one down.
Yeah. You don't want to debate me in a court of law. You don't want to debate me anywhere. I will turn the tables on you in a heartbeat because I have a brain that doesn't go in a linear direction. I found out I had ADD when I was young. I was never put on the Ritalin. I found out that I'm more of an Asperger's type. I have grandchildren that both have it, and of my six, and they're pretty high functioning. Also, it's just I had to spend a lot of quiet time when I was young in corners and stuff.
Yeah, I understand that.
It's lucky. I'm lucky. I've had a good career, post pro career. I've won, you know, more games than Satchel Paige. I won a pro game at 61, 63, 65, and 67. In my 60s, I will be known as undefeated in my 60s, which is a pretty good epitaph.
Not too shabby, Bill. Exactly. Now, you had your forays into politics as well. You ran for president under the Rhinoceros Party.
Yes.
Give us
Hunter
a little information.
My vice president. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. What was your platform back then, Bill?
No guns, no butter. They'll both kill you.
Okay.
They said I didn't want a military budget, and I didn't want a butter budget, which means spending on domestic spending. I basically am I'm what you call an Irish Scotsman that drinks a lot and doesn't want to pay for it.
Oh, that's all of us. Yeah. Yeah. Now, Bill, you were an ambassador to Major League Baseball to Cuba to help bring Cuban guys over to the U.S. You formed Goodwill Tours. You still working with that?
Yeah, I take Little League kids from here in Canada, and we go to Cuba for 5 weeks, and then we select one deserving team in Cuba, and we pay their way to America or Canada. And we show them, the other side of the coin, what happens when you don't have sanctions against your country. And, you know, I'm trying to, you know, use baseball as the belly button of the planet Earth and, show people that the game of baseball, when you learn to play baseball, you'll have world peace.
Yeah, that's exactly correct.
Yeah.
Now, also, Bill, another political aspiration of yours was running for governor of the great state of Vermont, the Liberty Union Party. Talk to us about that.
Well, we were more of a secessionist party. We wanted out of Vermont, and I just ran showing that a governor is just something that really retards people. You know, a governor on your car doesn't allow you to go any faster or be any better. And it's a very negative term, I believe. So I basically was doing away with the governorship. I ran for the thing to disband the government and to join with Quebec and become our own independent country and have free education, you know, free medical, you know, legalized pot. We were basically an anti-war party, which was actually Bernie Sanders' original party when he came to Vermont.
Right.
And then he became a progressive, a socialist, ran for mayor, and I actually helped him get elected as mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And then I ran as governor more as a, you know, just poking fun at the fact that it doesn't really matter. You know, as long as you have a national government that is non-functional. You know, I'm more of a states' rights guy. I'm more of an individual rights guy. And I believe in I adhere to two laws. Basically the law of averages in baseball and the law of gravity. And those are the only two laws I adhere to.
Wonderful laws to follow, too, Bill. Now, your slogan was, so far left, we're right.
That's right. Yeah. I always come up with pretty good slogans and
great t-shirt material.
Yeah, I do. I make t-shirts. My son does it. Is enjoy our derriere. You know, and it has a picture of a cow's ass.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Now, what folks wanted me to ask you when I announced you're coming on the show, Bill, was your relationship with the great late Warren Zevon.
Oh, my God, what a prophet. What an amazing guy. We miss him. We miss Hunter S. Thompson, Gore Vidal, Christopher Hitchens. We just need, you know, these people in this day and age to stand up to this improper form of questioning in our press and to really look at the big picture, not this tit for tat stuff and back and forth. And you know, I could handle North Korea so much better than Trump. And the more I look at it, I should have been president of the United States. You know,
yeah.
That guy couldn't lift Rosie O'Donnell off a platform. You know, as far as think he can get a nuclear warhead in orbit, I don't think so. You know, those people are so poor. They don't have a pot to piss in and a window to throw it out of.
No.
You know, they're a buffer between China and everything. And this is the detente of 1955 when the demilitarized zone was created. This is the same stuff as Vietnam. This stuff is so archaic. You know, I'm an anti-border guy. I'm a sans frontier, as they say in French. You know, I'm a man without borders. And
yeah.
When we all get that way, then we will live together independently and we'll be friends with everybody. But this creating fear and division, you know, over political boundaries is absurd. Syria, you know, Palestine, you know, a two-state solution. You know, there should be no state there. You know, North Dakota and South Dakota. You know, I mean, just let's all get together and get rid of all our divisions and our lines. You remember the movie, it was called Oblio in the Land of Point. Harry Nilsson, talking mm-hmm. about songwriters like Zevon. Harry Nilsson wrote a movie called The Point. And if every of your listeners get out and rent The Point, which was banned on CBS because it was so radical, it was a children's thing about Oblio in the Land of Point. You know, and it's uh-huh. Me and My Arrow. And it's a great song by Harry Nilsson, and we should all live by it.
What about Warren's tune, Bill Lee, from 1980?
That was nice, you know, through you. And if you do, they'll sit on your ass and nod at stupid things. Man, that's hard to do. And if they don't, you'll screw you. And if you do, they'll screw you, too. You know, and Glenn Frey did the harmonica on it. It was great. I used to live with these guys. I lived in Malibu. You know, I am Hotel California.
Yeah.
I am with the band. Levon Helm introduced me to my second wife. You know, I am a product of Malibu and California. And, you know, the land of fruits and nuts. And you can see why Zimmer didn't like me. You can see why the establishment doesn't like Californians, because we escape the East Coast bonds and we come out here and we just wave peacock feathers and jump in hot tubs and smoke dope.
Yeah.
You know, the rest of the world's trying to catch up to us, but they never will, because I'm out here, it's 92 degrees, no humidity, slight wind out of the northwest. You know, coming off the ocean, you know, it's just gorgeous. I'm eating a cassava Crenshaw melon grown on my own property. You know, I have walnuts, I have olives, I've got almonds, I've got pistachios. I'm in heaven. I'm in heaven, and the rest of the planet isn't.
Yeah, you're doing well, Bill. Now, also, there was another musical adaptation of Bill Lee by They Might Be Giants called What Bothers the Spaceman. How about that?
Oh, my God, there's tons of songs that have been out there about me. And I think I'm just flattered that I have a following of esoteric people that really think, you know, I've got the right answers, you know. And it's tough. I'm a left-hander that thinks with the right side of my brain. And as I say, left-handers are the only people in their right minds.
Right, exactly. And that should be another T-shirt right there.
That's another shirt right there. I'll tell you, I got more T-shirts, you know. I have the Jean-Paul Sartre one. You know, you're not here, I'm not here. There is no message, there is no beep.
Right, yeah. There you go. Now, Bill, we met in Cooperstown at the Cooperstown
yes.
Bat Company. What brought you up to Cooperstown this summer?
Fergie Jenkins, you know,
okay.
And you know, all the inductions of Timmy Raines, they wanted me there, and I'm a proponent of Expos, bring the Expos from Tampa Bay, which will probably, they may be blown off, the dome comes off of Tampa Bay, and they'll have to play the rest of their games up in Montreal, you know, and then
imagine.
We'll call them the Montreal X-Rays.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good one, Bill.
Yeah, I'm on. That's the way I think, you know, and it's, I believe that Montreal is 2.7 million, 3.5 around the area, all the way to the Vermont border. It touches Vermont. It touches upstate New York. You know, it touches New Hampshire and it touches Maine. And I'm going, those are all Red Sox fans. Those are all Toronto Blue Jay fans. Those are all New York Yankee fans. So put the damn team in Montreal in the American League East and let's play ball.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they definitely deserve another shot at it up there.
I agree.
Throughout your great illustrious career and lifetime, Bill, what do you consider your biggest thrill?
I think saving Fenway Park was my biggest added adjustment when I formed with the group Save Fenway Park when the Yawkey Foundation and the Yawkey Trust was going to move the ballpark. But they sold it to John Henry. John Henry agreed with me, and I saved Fenway Park. You know, and Babe Ruth spilt DNA in that park. He didn't spill any DNA in the new Yankee Stadium,
no.
But he did at Fenway Park.
Now,
and Baltimore, because I heard he had a bar in right field in Baltimore.
How about Yawkey? There's a guy for the ages, right?
Unbelievable. You know, I wrote a book called The Little Red Sox Book, which took exception to Yawkey's dislike of black ball players. I wrote a in 2004, I wrote it, and they win the World Series. You know, it was great. And I have a sign of me in 2006 carrying a street sign, Yawkey Boulevard, down Yawkey Boulevard in my Maoist hat.
Yeah.
So I believe they'll change that street to Bill Lee Boulevard eventually.
I think that should be done and be done right away. Who are some of your greatest teammates, Bill?
Willoughby, Wise, Jenkins, Carbo, you know, the Buffalo team. We all hung together. John Milner, Roland Office, Andre Dawson, Valentine, Rodney Scott in Montreal. You know, I kind of, they always said, Bill, you're the only white guy allowed on the back of the plane.
Yeah.
And that's how I conducted my life. And I was very well received. I was always elected by my peers to represent them in negotiations and in anything. And they all call me. That's the greatest thing is my phone is always ringing, and it's all the players that respected me. And they go, Bill, you know, you were right. And 20 years before, you were right. A prophet in his own time is not well respected.
Exactly. Very well put and so very true. Yeah. Where did you cross paths with John Milner, Bill?
Milner the Hammer used to play. He was came over from Dick Williams brought him over. Dick Williams.
Ah, with Montreal. Yeah, okay.
He was amazing. The reason we were good in 79, 80, and 81 was Dick Williams got the right players at the right time, and we all came together, and we just missed out on the playoffs 3 years in a row and got beat on Rick Mundy's home run in 81.
The great flag saver.
Yeah, the flag waver and stuff. And you know, we had one, too. His name was Cromarty. He used to run the Canadian flag around, too, and we were good. You know, if I come in to pitch to Monday in that Game 5, you know, we could have gone to the World Series and played the Yankees, and boy, I would have been on my top of my game right then.
Cromarty is a really big proponent, Bill, for bringing baseball back to Montreal.
Yeah, but he's like Pete Rose. He folds his bills up and puts rubber bands around him, and when you shake hands with him, you got to count your fingers.
Did you run across, if you did run across, maybe you were in a truck, did you run across Pete Rose up in Cooperstown?
I didn't see him at all this time, but I see him a lot, and we have a lot in common. You know, I got him elected in the trial, Pete Rose, it's on ESPN2, I think. It's called The Trial of the Century.
Okay.
You know, and I knew his ex-wife. She was tough. You know, she had Pete Rose arrested and his girlfriend in the Rolls Royce that he won in 75. You know, and that's a funny thing because it was registered in his ex-wife's name. And when he ended up separating from him, he forgot to change the title. And it's great that the ex-wife ends up doing a citizen's arrest on Pete and his girlfriend.
What do you think of the whole deal with him and the underage girl, Bill?
He's got no way. That's new. That's news to me.
Oh, you never heard that? Yeah.
Oh, there's a great song about that. 15, 16, 17, Jailbait. It's by a black singer back in the 60s. It's one of the great songs. Judge, you know, I plead insanity. I was crazy about that girl.
Yeah, I guess it came out around induction weekend in Cooperstown that he had something going with a teenage girl while he was in Cincinnati.
Wow. Well, it could have been when he was 25. You know, that's how the law states. You all assume it's right now, but it could have been a long, long time ago.
Well, you have to remember, Cincinnati is just across the river from Kentucky.
It is.
So you don't know.
Kentucky.
Right?
And Hustler Magazine came out of Cincinnati.
Yeah. So you know, it's the environment that's causing these troubles. How about some of your opponents that you played against, Bill? Who were some of the toughest guys, some guys that you owned?
Oh, Jackson I owned, Munson I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
Catchers, I couldn't get catchers out. I couldn't get out Buck Martinez, Ken Suarez. If you took all the catchers and lined them up, I bet they hit 300 lifetime against me. You know, they could read your hand. They're the guys that see the pitcher's hand all the time.
Right.
And to get a catcher out, you have to throw very hard because they're usually beat up. And I'm not a hard thrower. I trick you. You know, you aren't going to hit me out of the ballpark, but you can, if you're a smart hitter, you can put the ball in play the opposite field and beat me. But there ain't a lot of smart guys out there, and most people in Fenway want to pull the ball, and I was very blessed to pitch at Fenway Park, because if you try to pull me, I'll beat you.
That's outstanding. Now, Bill, I'd like to thank you for spending time out of your
great
Sunday
show,
night.
Great
to be
show.
With us.
Yeah, you're very quick. You understand the game, and you know, thanks for having me on.
No worries, Bill. You take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Say hello to all the Red Sox fans out in Montauk.
We'll do. All right. Bill Bye-bye. Lee, ladies and gentlemen. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Jerry Kramer and the Spaceman, Bill Lee. My engineer, Brian Graves, and of course you for joining us tonight. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. See you next time. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.